With temperatures in the teens and more snow on the way, this would be a good weekend to break out the knitting needles or try some for the first time. Nothing says winter warmth like a bunch of yarn in your hands. I'm Anne Strange-Champs, and this morning we're talking with knitting rock star Clara Parks. She's the founder and publisher of KnittersReview.com and author of a new memoir called The Yarn Whisperer, My Unexpected Life in Knitting. More than a decade ago, Clara left a career in Silicon Valley for a farmhouse on the coast of Maine and a new life as a knitting guru. What she discovered will resonate with anyone who's ever gotten so deeply involved with a craft or skill that it becomes a kind of metaphor for life. Knitters and crafters, we're hoping to hear from you this hour. If you've got questions for Clara Parks or want to talk about your life in knitting, the number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Clara, welcome to 45 North.
Good morning, Anne. Thank you for having me.
That's great to have you here. So tell me about your life in knitting. You left a career in Silicon Valley for a life with yarn on the coast of Maine. How did that happen?
Pretty crazy, huh? Well, a lot of people thought I was crazy, but
it sounds great to me.
Now it's funny when I think a lot of people can relate when you're in a conventional career that looks really good to the outside, and you know, you get formal people's approval. I got my grandfather's approval, and yet something in your soul just does not feel quite right. And you make the announcement that you're making a jailbreak. You're going to quit this stable career and move across the country to a place where people, they were like, Maine? Do you even have sidewalks in Maine? But then slowly people creep out of the woodwork and they start whispering like, you know, take me with you. Or they tell you their dreams of breaking away. So it's been wonderful. It was it's so many years ago now that I've stopped being able to count exactly. But
Well, it's been kind of like a I'm trying to think which fairy tale, you know, where you ditch the old life and begin a new one and it all works out. But so as publisher of KnittersReview.com, you've had a front row seat for the knitting revival, really. I mean, 10, 20 years ago, knitting was still kind of something grandmothers did. And now, I mean, we've got guerrilla knitters and craftsy girls, G-R-R-L-S, and guys who knit and movie stars who knit. And what do you think is fueling the knitting renaissance?
You know, I really think a lot of it has to do with the digitization of our lives over the last 15 to 20 years, that there's a fundamental human need to create or to be creative. And until very recently, you know, we had all sorts of outlets for that. We made our own homes. We made our own furniture. We made our shoes. Even if we had to make stone walls around our fields, we could build them just so to express ourselves. And even now, kind of the final nail in the coffin is the removal of handwriting, that now our greatest form of self-expression beyond our voice is a font of somebody else's creation. And I feel like knitting, along with so many of the other sort of artisanal movements that we have going on with beer and furniture and bicycles and chocolate and even the rise in tattoos, it's that fundamental need for creative expression is finding a way to spill out in something that allows us to lend our own personal imprint to the world around us.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And also, I sometimes think just the desire to use our hands, you know, at a really both of them together. I mean, there's something I think deeply satisfying about any craft that has you using your hands a lot. I don't know, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely, using your hands and also, I mean, there's the tradition of visual spatial tasks, simple repetitive motions to calm the mind, if they're prayer beads or worry beads or rosary beads. And what's beautiful about knitting is that you can do that and your hands are moving and they're connecting with your brain. But at the end of that session, you have a physical object to show for where your mind wandered while your hands were moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, the theme at the heart of this collection of stories, your memoir, is that what we knit says a lot about who we are. I think in your own words, we are what we knit. And you mean that, I think, not just literally, but figuratively. Can you kind of play that out a bit?
Yeah, we're definitely not hats or socks. But it's knitting, is rife with metaphors for life. I mean, we have so many other places, like in sailing. Sailing is a great place for metaphors, you know, charting your course, or you're in the doldrums, or you need leeway. But within knitting and within knitted fabric, which is really the underpinning of our world, knitted fabric, it represents the towel that you dried yourself off with this morning, or the clothing that you're wearing right now. It's all based on yarn. Or the sheets that you'll tuck yourself in tonight. It's all based on yarn.
Yeah, I suppose you could take, you could all see the history of civilization is the history of textile, right? I mean, going way, way back, I mean, the first things we began to grow to clothe ourselves.
Absolutely. And the first animal that we domesticated was the sheep. I mean, it has clothed us for as long as we thought it might be a wise idea to put clothing on. Yeah.
Well, and then so many people come together around knitting these days. I mean, the craft literally knits people together. I mean, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, for instance, there's a group of women who call themselves, I hope think they won't mind if I say their name on the air, the Wisconsin Public Broadcrafters. And I always think there's something, you know, very ancient and primal about these knitting circles, and a lot of them are women's knitting circles. What do you think?
I think there is definitely something primal. There's a feeling, even if it's almost intangible, but of tuning into a line of history. I don't quite know. You're tuning into all those other people, generations and generations and generations of people who took the same posture and made these same movements, and they connected over them and what they represented. I mean, people used to clothe their entire families solely from their own hands. And even now, there has to be kind of a cellular memory that is provoked when you take the stance of holding the yarn and needles in your hands and you start making those movements. And also, that is the amazing thing about knitting, is there's such a network. There's somehow, once it peels away layers that we normally keep to protect ourselves. So if you see somebody knitting, there's a safety that you know you can go up and approach that person. And 99% of the time, there will be a connection. And and in that regard, you need never be alone in this world. You move to a new town. You move to a new country. If you seek out the yarn, you will find a community that will let you in.
Oh, I love that idea. I've always been sort of jealous of my husband. So I'm not a sports fan, so I don't have that language, but I'm jealous of him. He grew up as a jock and he reads the sports pages first every day, and it is an automatic entree. He can talk to anybody by just saying, you know, the equivalent of "how about them Packers?" And I don't have that with people, but you're right. I do have with a lot of people, with anybody who knits, I have that. You can walk up and say, "Oh, what are you making?" Or, "I'm working on this or that."
You could be anywhere in the world. Their language barriers don't even count. You could be, you know, up in Peru, and you could point at some woman knitting and point at something that you're wearing, or even make – I've had friends – they don't speak a word of the other language, and they make hand gestures, and the other person makes hand gestures, and pretty soon you're all together. And what I find especially powerful about that, and this is an advantage you have over your husband, is that it can be your entree into the women's community, which in many other cultures can be very guarded and not something that you can easily step into as a stray tourist. But if you are showing you know how to do something that they know how to do, that they will let down their guard and let you in.
I want to take a couple of calls. We've got Maria on the line from Ladysmith, Wisconsin. Good morning, Maria.
Oh, good morning.
Hi. Are you a knitter?
I am a knitter. I started with my mother in Poland, and then we moved to America, and I've knitted everything. I didn't talk myself how to crochet through a friend, like you said, met them 20 years when I was, you know, divorced and all, and met through friends and started knitting and crocheting, and now I'm teaching my grandchildren. One is 8 years old and one is 12.
Oh, that's lovely. And what do you think knitting has given to your life, and what is it you love about it?
It's sitting down, and when I knit, I, like you said, you zone out and you just kind of complicate, you know, whatever's complicated in your day, it's kind of looking over it and sorting it through, and I'm at peace.
It's a lovely way to put it. Thank you so much for your call. Clara, you talk about that some, about the meditative piece of knitting when part of your body is busy and your mind is free. Is that part of the appeal for you?
Oh, absolutely. I really do think that the simple physical repetitive motion that occupies that part of your brain that tends to kind of chew on things in an unproductive way, and it frees up a big part of your mind to process things that happen, things that are troubling you, questions that you're trying to figure out in your mind, and just through 20, 30 minutes, it's really almost like a meditative practice, although it's also physical, you can sort things out. It's very helpful.
I think that's true of a lot of handcrafts. We've got a call from Willem in Colfax, who I think, hi, Willem, you're a potter, not a knitter?
Yeah. That's right. I'm a potter, but it involves that same sort of. I make functional pots. Lots of times I throw, repetitive forms or similar forms, and you get into that. I think it's called the flow process. That's sort of like meditation. Anyway, what I wanted to say about, I'm wearing a sweater right now that my mother knit and that I've had for 30 years. I have a whole bunch of things that she made, and I really value them. And like things that are made by hand, they carry a communication between people that mechanical things just don't possess. And so often people will remark on, in my case, on some pots that are maybe a little out of round, or there's something that happened in the firing, and they think of those as imperfections, but they're really reflections of the process and who we are as people. We're not machines. We're not perfect. You might have a mole or a pimple or something, but it's still a reflection of who we are, and I think those things are, William Morris talked about that, the reaction to the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Japanese philosopher, Tsuchiya Nagi, who talked about the art of the people, all these things that people used to do with their hands.
Japanese concept of wabi-sabi, right? The beauty of something that's imperfect.
Yeah, right, all that. So yeah. I really appreciate knitting. I'm glad it's making a comeback. I hope all the other handmade things that follow as well.
Yeah, well, I do too. Thank you so much for calling. Clara, I'm curious about, I really love Willem's point that there's a difference that we sort of just know intuitively between something that's machine or factory made and something that's made by hand. And I'm thinking about knitting, for instance. You can go to the store and buy a sweater that looks handmade, but I think you can tell the difference, and I'm not entirely sure why. What do you think?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it depends on how kind of woo-woo you want to get.
Go ahead.
It's just what he was saying. There's soul. There's some element, and maybe it's, I mean, to knit a sweater, that represents a great deal of energy that you're putting into something, attention and time. It's not a sheet knit in a factory and cut and, practically stapled together and stuffed in a bag and shipped to your nearest store. It's an expression. And there are also things in hand knitting that you can't really accomplish through mass production.
Really? Like what?
Well, like detailed shaping and seams, just a hand seamed garment has a different feeling to it, and that's kind of the knitter's handshake. You always reach in for the grab and then grab whatever they're wearing and say, "Ooh, did you make this?" And the first thing,
I love that the knitter's handshake.
It's very true, and the first thing, well, this is sort of the kind of embarrassing thing, like a tipping over a teacup to see who made it, but you flip inside to check the seams, because that's kind of your signature. How did you do the seams? How did you darn in the ends? And you were looking for even greater signs of humanity in something, because the pressure is, it's something that's absolutely perfect. And mine is never perfect. I like to leave a little element of wabi-sabi in there because we are human. You know?
Oh, well, that makes me feel so much better because I always, my knitting projects never come out exactly the way I wanted, and the seams look kind of funky. And mostly I feel like I just fail over and over again.
No, that's beautiful. You are bringing humanity into what you're making. Keep doing it. Keep doing it.
Okay. Let's talk with Mark from Richland Center. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I just wanted to mention that the whole idea behind repeating one thing over and over and over again is basically a repetition of nature itself. Because no matter how big the tree grows, it's really just one cell, one layer on top of another, one ring around the tree, around another. And so the process of knitting, it doesn't, you mentioned textiles, and fabric is basically just interlaced threads over and over and over again until you've got a sheet or until you've got some piece of fabric. And so I think that the process of knitting is really replicating what we've already learned from nature. And then when you turn it into mechanical movement, it absolutely amazes me that somebody could think about tying a knot with a machine, because the knotting process we did with our hands, but then you can come up with a machine that can actually turn a single strand of thread into a knot. And farmers watch this happen all summer long when they're baling hay. And maybe you don't give it a second thought, but it's a needle that pushes the thread through and then ties a knot to bale the hay. So it's an amazing process to watch all of this replication of nature in the way that we do things, whether it's with our hands or even with our machines.
Oh, thank you so much for calling, Mark. What a gorgeous comment. I love that idea that when we knit and we're knotting things, we're really trying to replicate what nature taught us to begin with. You know, maybe that's the origins of textile. We're talking this morning with Clara Parks. She's the author of The Yarn Whisperer, and previously The Knitter's Book of Yarn, The Knitter's Book of Wool, and The Knitter's Book of Socks. She's also the founder and publisher of KnittersReview.com. It's a bi-weekly e-newsletter that explores the pleasures and subtleties of yarn. So listen, you can join our conversation. Are you a knitter? What do you love about knitting, and what kind of life lessons have you found in whatever kind of handcraft you do? You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 4 on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Jean Purcell look at a new report on gun access by the mentally ill. They review holiday movies, and they'll look at the week in state news. Later this hour, we'll be talking with G. Willow Wilson about writing fantasy in a post-9/11 world. She just won the World Fantasy Award for her YA novel, Aleph the Unseen. I'm Anne Strange-Champson. We're talking about knitting this morning with knitting rock goddess Clara Parks. She's the author of The Yarn Whisperer. And Clara, I wanted to ask you really quickly, you write a lot in the book about knitting as a metaphor for life and about the way you can kind of tease out life lessons from knitting. And one example you give is of a technique called cutting a steek, which I've never been brave enough to try. And you kind of draw that out as a metaphor for a particular family trauma you went through as a young girl when your parents divorced. Can you kind of play that out a bit for us?
Yeah, well, a steek is a traditional technique for cutting open a piece of knitted fabric, because if you just cut open a random piece of knitted fabric, the ends would very quickly just unravel because they're looking for a hand to hold. And so there's a technique where you build up a barrier of stitches to protect the fabric so that you can cut it open. And as I was kind of looking through my own story and thinking about knitting in general, I realized that was exactly kind of, if you work a steak without preparing, everything unravels. And when I was 8, my parents got divorced, and my mother was in the middle of getting her doctorate in flute performance, and she needed to leave and move to another state to finish that. And so in my mind, how I remember it, even though I know, the adult in me knows this isn't how it happened, but it was just that I came home one day, the house was packed, we had to get in a car and drive away, and that was it. And I've spent many, many years kind of picking up all the different threads that got unraveled, trying to find home from that cut, that when you shock, when your life is shocked in such a way, really the natural tendency is to unravel. And then when I thought about knitting, I realized, oh, it doesn't need to be that way, that you can prepare for an abrupt change, just as you do in knitting, building up that barrier of stitches. And in my case, it was, all right, I know I want to cut free from the West Coast and move to the East Coast. I'm going to give myself several years to figure this one out and not make that first cut until I feel absolutely prepared. And it was an amazing difference in how two similar cross-country moves could be experienced based on a simple knitting technique.
See, I love that. You gave me the concept of cutting a steek in your own life. We've got more folks calling who want to add to our conversation. Let's hear from Valerie in Oshkosh. Hi, Valerie.
Hi there. Hi, Claire. I feel like a little bit of a sister in knitting because about 30 years ago, I lived on the coast of Maine as a nanny and I learned how to knit, and I've been doing it ever since. And it is one of the best places to find yarn. You probably have found that. And what I wanted to comment on is that I have heard that knitting is a great way to keep your memory sharp. And I do recall vaguely a study that talked about knitting as one of the ways to prevent Alzheimer's, possibly, just because of the, you know, sometimes there's counting involved. Sometimes there's a little bit of keeping track of a pattern. And, you know, you have to examine your work as you go along and you get familiar with the minutiae of the stitches. So I just wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, is there a neuroscience of knitting?
I'm confident that there absolutely has to be. I think it's the hand-eye coordination. I think you're absolutely right. And I vaguely remember that same study. Your mind is processing so much. You are, even if you're not sitting there saying 1, 2, 3, deep in your mind, you are keeping track and you are remembering things. And then, like, if you're working a stitch pattern, a repeat, you have to quickly remember one row and then erase it from your memory and remember the next row and then erase it. And so I think absolutely it's a fantastic memory technique.
Hmm. We've also got Corinne on the line from Richland Center. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi there. I loved what you're talking about. I'm 80 years old, and I knit about 50 years ago. I made one two-needle sock, and I only made one. Only it was brown, and I decided I'd give it to the nursing home for a man who had leg surgery, and he needed one foot covered. So I thought I'd put that one to good use. But I wasn't very good at knitting two needles, so it just wasn't something I did. I'd rather sew. But this is what I want to tell you. About the last month, I've had eye surgery, cataracts and all. And at 80, there's things I want to do. I can't even thread a needle anymore, basically. But I had been looking at some magazines. And I told your interpreter here in the beginning that this is what I found in the magazine. So whether it's knitting, crocheting, or whatever, I found this woman wrapped in an afghan. Now, you know what I mean? On the back of a Davenport, the afghan.
Yeah.
She was wearing it. Now we're back into wearing these older things, and I'm pleased about it.
Well, it's great. It's really wonderful to see things coming back again, isn't it? Corinne, thanks for your call. And let's hear from Hannah, who's calling from Madison. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. I am 29 years old, and I've been knitting since third grade.
Wow.
And I learned from, funnily enough, a woman named Mrs. Yarny.
You're kidding, Mrs. Yarny?
Yep. She's my third grade teacher, and she, during her lunch hour, taught us how to knit. And the first project I ever made was a scarf. And since then, I've had many failures and many successes in projects that I've chosen to make. And right now I'm I'm 6 months pregnant, and I have a 3-year-old son.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I've been this knitting, and like I've learned how to sew from my parents, from my mom and from my grandmother, and these crafts that I know how to do has just inspired me to do things for my children, that like making them clothes or Halloween costumes, things that, you know, they're going to find so special and remember for the rest of their lives, that they had someone who took the time to make these projects for them. And it's not like everyday clothing, but it's something like, you know, my son got a turtle costume for Halloween that I couldn't find in the store.
And I have to tell you, I still have the Halloween costumes that my mother sewed for me years ago. They're still the fairy costume and the bride costume, and they're beautiful.
Yeah, and I do too. I have things that we've passed down from generation to generation that I can't, you know, I don't always remember, but I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they spent this much time. And it's not just the item that I have now, it's the fact that now I know how to do all of this.
Right,
and
right.
It's so empowering for me to know that I could sit down and knit a sweater or or sew something for my kids and feel accomplished in doing it. And, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And my husband thinks it's so funny because I'll be sitting there and I'll get so mad over something. And then it's a release for what you're feeling maybe towards something else. But you realize that, you know, by putting it into this work, you're going to create something that, you know,
will last for a long time.
Hi.
Thank you so much for calling. That's lovely. Clara, what's your favorite kind of knitting to do?
My favorite. Now, this is some knitters are going to cringe when I say this, but my favorite thing to do is swatch, which is basically
Well, you have to explain for people who don't know what swatching is.
Swatching, it's kind of like doodling. It's what you do when you're first taking yarn out for a test drive, and most of the time we're so eager to get started, you know, to get married and start a family together with this yarn that we don't bother with dating it very much. And swatching is the dating. It's just taking it out. It's a square or a rectangle.
So you just make a little, it's a little trial run. You just try a little trial without a pattern or anything, and you just knit maybe just a little square, and partly to check your stitch gauge to make sure when you do pick up a pattern, you know what it's going to be like. But most people don't like doing that or regard it just as a little chore, but you actually like it?
I enjoy it because it's for me, I swatch. I mean, part of my work is to review yarns, to test yarns. So I love it because it's devoid of any real goal. It's just taking yarn out for a stroll. I'm not thinking about, oh, I have to do a second sleeve or a second sock or, oh, I've only done the front. I haven't done the back yet. I'm just experiencing this yarn. And you can change needles. You can change stitches. And you really, I don't know, just get to play with your intuition. And if I love a yarn, the swatch just keeps going and going. And then I have a scarf.
You know, so I read that in your book. You've got this beautiful kind of meditation on swatching. And it completely freed me because most, you know what I thought? I thought, oh, I could go ahead and buy all the yarn I want. I don't have to have the pattern ahead of time. Because so often, you know, you go in a yarn store, and even for people who don't knit, I would highly encourage anybody to go into a yarn store. These places are gorgeous, the colors and the textures. And especially in winter, when it's all cold outside, it's just a blast of warmth. You must have a yarn Jones also.
Oh, completely. I mean, and I would add the smell of yarn stores, the smell of the lanolin and the wool, and the textures and the colors. It's really, someone described when knitters gather at festivals or things that it's a convention of cats, that we're just wandering around touching things. Going, ooh, brr, 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 that's nice. Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. So, yes, I'm happy to enable you. Go forth and acquire single skeins.
Thank you. Clara, it's been lovely talking with you this morning. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure.
Clara Parks is the author of The Yarn Whisperer, and she's also written 3 previous books about knitting, The Knitter's Book of Yarn, Book of Wool, Book of Socks. She's the founder and publisher of KnittersReview.com, a biweekly e-newsletter that explores the pleasures and subtleties of yarn. You are listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. G. Willow Wilson just won the World Fantasy Award for her novel Aleph the Unseen. A young Arab hacker is caught up in a secret plot involving quantum computing and state-sponsored espionage, along with a magical book and mythical creatures straight out of the Arabian fairy tales. It's been called a multicultural Harry Potter for the digital age and a reminder of how far fantasy has come since Tolkien. Willow, do you think fantasy is having a renaissance?
You know, I do. It's very interesting what's been going on in fantasy in the past decade or so. I think there's been a real opening up. It's always been a genre that has addressed through allegory and through parallels issues of the day that we're concerned about in our real lives. You know, you go all the way back to Tolkien and Lewis, who were addressing some of the big questions that arose in World War I and World War II, questions of the problem of evil and the way that war had changed in the modern era. And then you come up through today and we're talking about gender and sexuality and minorities and making more room for more people at the table, which I think is a very good thing.
A lot of us grew up on that earlier generation of fantasy writing. And of course, there's yet another Hobbit movie coming to the theaters. So we're obviously still under the Tolkien spell. As a fantasy writer yourself, what seems to you maybe kind of dated about Tolkien's world?
The wonderful thing about Tolkien is that it does in some ways transcend the time that it was written. In other ways, you can see that times have really changed. I think in the portrayal, for example, of the quote-unquote bad guys, the bad guy races, that he really has that classic fantasy association between ugliness and evil. That if you are physically ugly in the eyes of you know, the reader or the author, that means that there's something corrupt inside you as well. And I think that sort of plays into a lot of issues surrounding race and disability, which at the time were the conversation was a lot less developed.
Do you see any echoes of racism in Tolkien?
I don't think he was an overtly racist man. And in fact, he was staunchly opposed to the Nazis in World War II and also to apartheid in South Africa, which he saw as unconscionable. So he was a man of great principle. However, I think you really can't fight the environment into which you're born and which you're raised. And so, you know, the fact that the orcs and the great threat comes out of the east, and that there are these very obvious Arab or North African mercenaries with those great, you know, pseudo elephants that they ride into battle.
Yes.
Yeah, and those are, you know, the Easterlings are a big threat. So I think in terms of just kind of geographically dividing up the world into light-skinned northwestern good guys and dark-skinned southeastern bad guys, he was certainly echoing the thoughts of his time.
Mm. Well, and also those earlier fantasies, the world was pretty much always divided into good and evil in a fairly simplistic way. I mean, today, take something like, Game of Thrones, which had millions of people glued to their televisions, despite the fact that all the good guys pretty much wind up dead, which makes me wonder whether contemporary fantasy is simply getting a lot bleaker, a lot more pessimistic. We no longer assume good will inevitably triumph.
That's a very interesting observation, and I think you might be right. Certainly, Game of Thrones is one of the most wretched things to read or watch if you're the kind of person that gets really attached to the characters in a book, because they do drop like flies. But I cannot help but think that even if you know, 99% of the people that we love to read in those books or watch on television die off, that there will be one surviving character who somehow turns things around. Because I think that is, in a way, kind of part of the point of fantasy. It is to tell ourselves that there is goodness left even in those bleakest of times.
What do you make of the fact that the other very powerful contemporary trope is the evil zombie hordes?
You know, I find that very interesting. I think we're so concerned now with kind of the state of the planet as a whole. We've got climate change, we've got water shortages and food scarcities. And I think zombies are, in a way, a natural fantasy or sci-fi outgrowth of those concerns, because we're worried about some kind of planet-wide disaster. There's an almost Malthusian element to the zombie myth, because it feeds on our fear that there's just too many people and that somehow the Earth is going to come back and wipe the slate clean.
So this is fascinating. You're really sketching out a number of, I guess you could call them post-9/11 fantasies. We should talk about your own most recent novel, Aleph the Unseen. It's set in a city called simply The City, though I'm guessing it might have a lot in common with Cairo, a city where you lived for many years.
It does in some sense. The old city, the old quarter in the city is directly drawn from old Cairo. In Cairo, there is, of course, the citadel of Salah ad-Din, the famous medieval Arab general. And inside it is a very beautiful Ottoman mosque. And the old city is kind of at the outskirts of this hill. The old quarter in my fictional city is drawn directly from that.
Well, there's a character in your novel who says at one point she thinks of the city as a woman, or the city is female. I can't remember what else she says, but it's a beautiful passage.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and that's also drawn from Cairo. The name for Cairo in Arabic is Al-Qahira, the conqueress. So she's considered female, and people speak of the city as her. Things are always gendered in Arabic, and Cairo is a she. And so that is something I also drew on when writing this book and thought, well, this city is also a female city.
Well, there's a lot of female power in this novel. Also, you have some very strong women characters. You know, one of your strongest is a young woman, Dina, who has chosen to wear the veil, which Westerners see as a mark of passivity, maybe. Tell us about Dina.
You know, she was really a challenge that I put for myself. I wondered how much range of expression and emotion I could get out of a character whose face we never see. She, to me, was really representative of the kinds of women that I met who had chosen to veil their faces. Often they do so over the objections of their family. And so it's often a mark of defiance. It would be a mistake to say that that's always true, because there certainly are instances in which women are forced to wear the veil.
Why would a young woman choose to wear the veil against her family's wishes?
You know, if you asked five different women, you'd probably get five different answers. But I think often it's a way of rebelling against the perceived materialistic nature of a certain generation, especially in the Middle East. You know, in the 70s and 80s, there was a great opening up of the economies there, and all of a sudden there were luxury goods, and people were wearing the same miniskirts and bouffant kinds of hairdos in the 60s and 70s that people were wearing here. And then in the 80s and 90s, there was a real backlash against that, and a sense that people felt they had lost their identity and lost their roots, and religion was a big part of that. And so often what you see today is younger girls putting on the headscarves that their mothers took off as a way of saying, I want to reclaim my identity. I don't want to be just a fake Westerner. I want to be a real Arab. And so there's a lot of conversation about what that means and what authenticity is. And the veil has become a big part of that and a big point of debate among many people.
So interesting, because veils and what's hidden are themes that are very old in the fantasy genre and that you take on in different ways. Do you think that Eastern and Western cultures have different approaches to the concept of what's hidden?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I think especially in the context of the Middle East, where the book is set, there is such a different understanding of what it means to keep something private. You know, it's the most sacred things in Arab culture are hidden. The Kaaba, for example. If you've seen pictures of the Hajj and you see a picture of the Kaaba, which is the cube-shaped house in the middle of Mecca, it's always wearing a veil. It's got a black shroud over it. The faces of angels and prophets in Islamic art are always veiled. Heaven is veiled. We can't see it. And so there's a very different understanding of what it means to be hidden. And even in the title of the book, Aleph the Unseen, I kind of wanted to play with that a little bit.
We should talk some about Aleph, the protagonist hero, who is a computer programmer, a hacker. He seems to be such an homage to the young people who created the Arab Spring. Was that in your mind when you were creating his character?
Absolutely. When I was writing him, there was no Arab Spring yet. I mean, really, the seeds for this book were planted when I was working as a journalist in Egypt, and I was covering the 2005 presidential elections, in heavy air quotes. They weren't really elections as such. You walked into a booth and you could really say yes or no to the existing president, Hosni Mubarak. But for the first time, they were sort of loosening the strings a little bit. And for the first time, there was this internet medium that was very difficult to censor. Blogs were hosted in different countries, people used screen names, and so it was very difficult to track them down. And of course, once you put something online, even if you take down the original site, it's already going to be in 1,000 different places by the time you do that. And so young, very young, 18, 19-year-old bloggers were saying some very courageous things, were criticizing the status quo in a way that their parents had been afraid to do, in a way that you couldn't do in television or media or print or anything like that. And the regime was very threatened, and it started arresting bloggers. And I realized that this new media was going to have a huge political impact on life in the Middle East. But it was a very hard sell.
You couldn't get stories about that?
No, no. It was people weren't interested. They say, well, you know, the internet isn't really a place. You can't describe it. People aren't going to be interested. And there was this real silence libel, I feel, against Gen Y. I mean, there was this idea that they were just texting slackers with no social consciousness and they would never amount to anything, which I, as an elder statesman of Gen Y, knew to be untrue. And so I tried to write nonfiction pieces about these young hackers and bloggers and hacktivists that were coming to the fore in 2005, and no one was interested. So I decided to put it all in a novel, and that was really how Aleph came about. And so when the Arab Spring did come around, I had a lot of very satisfying, you were right, I was wrong conversations with people.
Well, speaking of the prescience of this book, I wanted to ask you to read a passage just to give us a bit of the flavor of Aleph's world.
Sure. So this is a section in which Aleph is talking about why it is he does what he does. He shields dissidents of all stripes, no matter their ideology. He will protect atheists and feminists and Islamists and anarchists. Anybody who can pay him, in his opinion, deserves his protection, because it's really the state and its censorship that makes him angry. And so in this, he's sort of reflecting on that. It was the censors who made him grind his teeth as he slept, the censors who smothered all enterprise, whether saintly or cynical. Half the world lived under their digital cloud of ones and zeros, denied free access to the economy of information. Aleph and his friends read the complaints of their coddled American and British counterparts. Activists all talk, irritated by some new piece of digital monitoring legislation or another, and laughed. Ignorant monoglots, Abdullah called them when he was in the mood to speak English. They had no idea what it was like to operate in the city, or any city that did not come pre-wrapped in sanitary postal codes and tidy laws. They had no idea what it was like to live in a place that boasted one of the most sophisticated digital policing systems in the world, but no proper mail service. Emirates with princes in silver-plated cars, and districts with no running water. An internet where every blog, every chat room, every forum was monitored for illegal expressions of distress and discontent. Their day will come, Abdullah had told him once. They had been smoking a well-packed hookah on the back stoop of Radio Sheikh, watching a couple of feral cats breed on a garbage heap. They will wake up one morning and realize their civilization has been pulled out from under them inch by inch, dollar by dollar, just as ours was. They will know what it is to have been asleep for the most important century of their history. That doesn't help, Aleph had said. No, said Abdullah, but it certainly makes me feel better.
So how do you, against this, you've set this political, very contemporary technological world, and into that you bring magic. How do you combine magic and computers? They would seem to be antithetical to each other.
You know, my interest in computers came about because I like my machines to work, but I'm too lazy to work them myself. And so I collected this wonderful array of tech-savvy programmers and friends who I would turn to in moments of distress. And at one point, I had a conversation with a wonderful programmer friend of mine of Indian origin, and he was trying to explain quantum computing to me. And to do that, he used a metaphor between monotheism and polytheism. And he said, our regular computers, our digital computers, are monotheists. You know, everything is black and white. There's a single origin point. Everything is a one or a zero. Whereas quantum computing is polytheist. It recognizes multiple origin points and information that relates to itself in very different ways. And we went on in this conversation, and eventually I said, are we still talking about computers, or have we started to just talk about religion? And he just laughed. And I thought that was so great. And really, it struck me that magic and religion are in essence just human operating systems. They're ways that we process information from the world around us. And so the overlap to me was fairly significant, and I really wanted to tease that out in the form of a story.
So is this what happens to Aleph? Because he starts out as a computer programmer, somebody who believes that he can make a computer do anything, and he has no use for religion at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is forced to confront a magical world.
I think so. I mean, he is really, he's kind of a geek in the classic sense of the word. You know, he loves computers and he reads fantasy novels and comics. And I think I really just sort of wanted to play with that tension between, fantasy as a fiction and the possibility of these magical things really existing. And ironically, it's Dina who's, the very religious, very conservative friend of his, who more readily accepts these things because the sort of the irrational and the transcendent are already part of her daily life. Mm. And so I really wanted to, go at the transcendent and the unseen and the magical from the point of view of the clash between religious and secular philosophy to kind of challenge the assumptions of both.
And this must, I'm guessing, grow out of your own personal experience, having grown up in the West and in, I think, a very secular family from mm-hmm. what I've read, and then converting to Islam. So how much of this was your own path?
There's certainly a parallel with my own life. And in certain instances, actually, bits of dialogue will be lifted straight from conversations that I've had with other people.
Really? For example?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. The conversation about fictional pork that occurs in the mosque when they're talking about video games was actually a conversation that I had in-game playing, and now I'm going to admit to my shameful geeky habits, World of Warcraft with another American Muslim friend of mine. And we were standing around as our little, elf and dwarf avatars, having a discussion about whether this, food that you gather in the game, some of which is pork-based, was acceptable to eat or
right.
not, because of course you're not really eating it. And all of these hilarious questions raised by life in this very postmodern era when you're interfacing with mm-hmm. a tradition that goes back 1,000+ years.
What was it about Islam that you first fell in love with? Was it the mystical side of Islam?
I always knew what kind of monotheist I was. Looking at the world and sort of the amazing way in which good and bad is intertwined and you can't tease them apart. And that to me was very important. And I needed something that really encompassed the good and the bad in the world without resorting to dualism, without saying like, well, the good stuff is from God and then the bad stuff is from, Satan or some other person. That was not what I believed. And so I needed a very, very big idea of what God was. And Islam really reflected that back to me. I was very taken, for example, with the 99 names of God, in which God is both the beneficent and the merciful and the loving and also the debaser and the bringer of death and all of those things at once. And you cannot separate one from the other. You can't decide, okay, today I'm going to talk to the merciful God and tomorrow I'm going to talk to this other. It's all one being with this incredible multifaceted makeup, and that was very powerful to me.
And going back to our earlier discussion of classic fantasy, the Tolkien era fantasy maybe did have a more dualistic mm-hmm. form of monotheism in which there is a clear good and a clear bad. In that way, do you see what you're doing as post 9/11 fantasy?
I think in a certain sense, yes, because I think really, especially in the United States, we've become a lot more concerned with the way that our attempts to do good often go terribly wrong mm-hmm. and involve these incredibly complex after effects that we didn't predict. I'm thinking, of course, of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, where, going in, we thought we were doing something really good. We're going to get the terrorists. We're going to free these people who've been living under this dictatorship, or in the case of Afghanistan, living with the threat of the Taliban. And then there were all of these after effects that we didn't anticipate. And now there's a real soberness, I think, in American discussions about war that was not there before. And that we do recognize that sometimes our best intentions can lead us down some very dark paths. And that is something that I do try to reflect in my own fantasy, that sometimes the path to goodness is not clear. And sometimes it involves side effects that you would rather not contemplate. And so in that sense, I think, yeah, I do try to bring in that level of complexity. And I think that's true of a lot of modern fantasy. And it's not just post 9/11. It may even have started after Vietnam, when we started to really think about what it means to have power. And I think all of the best modern fantasy addresses that in some way.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you for having me.
G. Willow Wilson recently won the World Fantasy Award for her novel Aleph the Unseen. You'll find more information about her and her work on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. I'm Anne Strain Champs, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.